Man, five, hell four, gapes, three, Erebus now lies two, open. The mouths of death zero, wait on thy end.
Hear now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on anonradio.net.
This is episode 87, presenting chapters 11 through 15 of By Air Express to Venus, or Captives of a Strange People by Roy Rockwood. This is the first time I've done a show with all Air Express to Venus chapters. I had a request from a listener not to mix different books in the course of a single show, and so I'm going to try that out. Although some of the books I have read have very long chapters, and when a chapter is, let's say, 30 or 40 minutes long, I have the choice of cutting the show short or putting something else in as well. But I suppose we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Quite a few incidents in the course of these five chapters, some of them absolutely absurd. I'm sorry, but orbital mechanics just does not work like that. We're treated to what reminds me of the Venusian Aikido from Doctor Who, and reminded not to take our masks off before it's completely safe. We get a glimpse of deflector beams, and it is revealed that the Venusians do indeed use telephones, so why Gozona was so perplexed by one at the beginning of the book becomes a complete mystery. For longtime listeners, a bigger mystery may be, what have I been doing since show number 86? And this is a question that I am sadly not well able to answer. While I cannot promise two new shows a week, I certainly do not intend to take another such hiatus in the future. One thing is for certain, I have quite a lot of material recorded and ready to be edited to make up new shows. The big news is undoubtedly that I am leaving Twitch as a streaming platform. The SDF video platform, TubeNix, which is an instance of PeerTube, is now supporting live streaming, and that's where I am going to be streaming from now on. I plan to do one final Twitch stream to let everybody know of my intention of moving, and then it will be on live.tubenix.org from then on. And you can find the link to my Hear Now the Word channel either under the DJs tab at the Anon Radio website, under Publius, and you have to find the Hear Now the Word master post, or you can go to my SDF-hosted website homepage, publius.ntfn.org. That's Papa Uniform Bravo Lima India Uniform Sierra dot November Tango Foxtrot November dot Oscar Romeo Golf, and scroll down to Live Action Audiobooks to find the link. Chapter 11, Blasts of Ether. For several tense moments, a space of time that seemed longer than it really was, Mark Sampson, Jack Darrow, and Professor Gustavus Hertz stood at their posts, their masks covering their faces, intently watching Protexa and Soli, who were close to the engine of gold. Its deadly drawing power had been neutralized now that it was functioning to help send the blue streak through space. Suddenly, the Venusian engineer, who had been closely observing a clock gauge, pushed forward a lever. There was a further vibration of the air express, and Mark and Jack wondered what was going to happen. But all that occurred was that Protexa removed his mask and motioned to the others to do the same. Since their entire heads were covered, they could not hear his voice. "Well, that's a relief," exclaimed Jack, as he laid aside the grotesque protector. "I should say so," agreed his chum. "It was not exactly pleasant," admitted Professor Hertz, as he laid aside his head covering. "But I suppose it was necessary."
very necessary, stated Protexa. Without them, as we pass through the atmosphere of your Earth, we should all have been killed, but there is no more danger.
How about it when we strike the atmosphere of Venus? Asked Jack. Shall we have to put on the masks again?
The chief engineer shook his head in negation.
Our atmosphere is not like yours, he said. However, have no fears, he added quickly, as he saw what was engendered in the minds of the others. You will be able to breathe it even as we breathed yours. The atmosphere of Venus lacks certain elements which the Earth air has, and which, in conjunction with the emanations from our propelling gas, mean danger on your planet.
Then I am right in assuming that this blue streak is propelled by the issuance of exploding gas, just as is a rocket, asked the German scientist eagerly. For, up to now, the exact method of sending the Air Express through space had been a jealously guarded secret from the Earth dwellers, notwithstanding that they had worked on the machinery, including the engine of gold.
It operates on the rocket principle, admitted Protexa, but in a much more powerful fashion than any machine you have ever seen.
In one way, this trip was no novelty to the three Earth passengers, since they had several times sailed through immense spaces in a machine somewhat similar to the Blue Streak. But it was their hope and expectation that on Venus they would encounter beings new and strange to them, and that they would have some novel experiences. Professor Hertz hoped to be able to make some valuable scientific observations, and to settle long-disputed questions regarding the planet. Having set the machinery to produce the maximum speed of their air express, and also having adjusted the guiding compass so that it would keep the great projectile pointed for Venus, Protexa stated that no further attention need be paid to the apparatus unless something unforeseen should occur.
"So you may wander about as you please," he told Professor Hertz and the two young students. "Jantu you will, of course, not disturb," he added gravely.
There seemed to the young man to be something that Protexa was keeping back. However, what he said next occupied Jack and Mark to the exclusion of worrisome thoughts, at least for a time.
"You Earth dwellers," went on the Venusian with a smile, "will naturally want to eat the Earth food you have brought with you. You may make your own cooking and meal arrangements. As for my companions and me, we drink only Bitam, and for food smell Gasto. It saves much time," he suggested.
"Indeed it does," agreed Professor Hertz. "I have often felt how foolish it is to spend so many hours preparing food which is disposed of in so short a time at a table. Your way seems much better, my friend Protexa, though I cannot deny," he added with a smile, "that I like my food."
"Same here," echoed Jack.
Mark wondered if it did not take time to distill the gasto from flowers, though all he said aloud was, "When we get to Venus, we may do as the Venusians do."
"I fear it will take more than a brief stay on our planet to enable you to live on Bitam and Gasto," said Gozona with a smile as she approached the group in the engine room. "But I hope you will stay with us a long time," she added genially.
"Is there any food there we can eat?" asked Jack, and the same thought was in Mark's mind as was in his, that he would not object to living on Venus the rest of his life if he could have the companionship of Gozona.
"From what I have observed of you while we were on your Earth," said the girl in blue, "I should say that you might be able to exist on Venus as you do on your own planet, but that remains to be seen. We are still a long way off."
"But we're getting there," exclaimed Jack, looking at a speed gauge and observing that they were exceeding 345,000 miles per hour. But in the solid air express, breathing the same atmosphere as that of the Earth, the air being distilled from certain chemicals on board, they were hardly sensible of their motion, so smooth was it. The Blue Streak was not like an airship as ordinarily constructed. It was more like the machines in which Mark and Jack had visited the Moon and Mars, as well as the city beyond the clouds, and so straight and swift did it progress that it was like riding inside a bullet. There were no air pockets or bumps to shake up and disconcert the travelers. "We certainly got off to a blaze of fireworks," chuckled Jack, as they left the
number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Here now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Aha! Okay, I apologize for the late start. Fact is, I had gone into town to pick up the keys that I had made, new keys for the locks for the payphones, and unfortunately, you know, time was a little tight, but I thought I'd be okay. Unfortunately, there was some kind of signaling problem on the subway line. We were held a couple of times going one way, the other way. I don't know what it was, but, you know, the sign says, next train 3 minutes, 5 minutes later. Next train 2 minutes. Not a good thing. That was an annoyance. Let me close the window for sound. It continues chilly and unpleasant here in Munich, weather-wise. Rain, temperatures around 0 degrees C. In fact, I think they were predicting -2 for tomorrow sometime, which is not pleasing to me. And overcast, of course. end of April, beginning of May, I was hoping it would be sunny and warm, and apparently it was before I got here. Anyway. I've been spending some time today transferring the supporting calculations for number one of BLAST into my into the web page. Which is notes on number one. Let's see. It's a big table. It's got 27 years. Because that's as far as I carried the calculation out. And I've got the kettle boiling in the next room for a cup of hot tea, which I might want. As I say, it's been cold. I may want to just move this supporting calculation to the bottom of the page because it is kind of big. Anyway, what am I actually doing here? I should be reading something to you, but I don't know if you want me to read the notes to number one of BLAST, which I've so far been putting together. So for those of you who have a copy at hand, for page 3, I say, let's see. All of this changed forever in 1939 when Halbin and Kovarsky measured the multiplication of neutrons in uranium oxide powder suspended in heavy water. A self-propagating nuclear reaction implied that the energy locked up in atoms, a million times greater than that in the chemical bonds between them, could be released. At least one person recognized that change immediately. Frederick Joliot, head of the laboratory, and Marie Curie's son-in-law, rushed across town to the offices of the Union Minière du Haut-Katanga, the world's leading producer of uranium in those days, to negotiate an agreement for cooperation in the peaceful uses of the energy liberated in nuclear fission. And then I have a note to this on the webpage that says, for Frederick Joliot Curie's actions immediately following the first measurement of neutron multiplication, see The Atomic Complex by Bertrand Goldschmidt, published in English translation by the American Nuclear Society in 1980. Goldschmidt, much like Glenn Seaborg, was a scientist first. He was in the room with Halbin and Kovarsky that day in 1939, who participated in the Manhattan Project on behalf of Free France and later came to serve as a senior administrator. There were very few French in the Manhattan Project, and they were all confined to the Montreal laboratory. Okay, and then on page nine, I say. And of course it flops over to page 11. So long as an evil seems necessary, it will not lack defenders. Take away that necessity and support evaporates. So, once steam provided an alternative to muscle for converting stored chemical energy into mechanical work, a road opened to abolishing slavery and serfdom. Likewise, in a poor society, most people will be poor no matter what, and it may seem a small hardship that they should be poorer yet so that very few can be wealthy. But in a wealthy society, poverty becomes difficult to defend, and a wealthy society must be a high-energy society because energy replaces or makes up for things that are actually scarce. And the note that I have to this is, we will have more to say concerning the triumph of the masters of steam engines over the masters of slaves in the American Civil War in a future number. For the present, we may refer to the famous Am I Not a Man and a Brother tokens, and I've got a link there to the Yale Art Gallery to show what this looks like, which circulated in Britain at the end of the 18th century, among many other such copper tokens, which made up for the lack of official small change. These Condor tokens were produced primarily in Birmingham, and the most notable producer was the firm of Bolton and Watt. Yes, that Watt. Arguably the first steam-powered manufacturing establishment in the world, Bolton and Watt achieved such technical perfection with tokens that they were ultimately chosen to supply the regal copper coinage of 1797, which rapidly drove the Condors out of circulation. Let's see. And on page 12, meanwhile in Germany, which has pursued the wind and sun path for more than 20 years, to great fanfare and at enormous expense, the lignite pits grow daily, devouring villages, ancient forests, and even wind power installations. German emissions per head of population or euro of economic output are twice those of France, and the combination of high power prices and insecure supply is driving away industries. None of this gives color of plausibility to pursuing such policies in other countries. Meanwhile in Germany, on the effectiveness of the Energiewende, see, for example, a website, Is Germany Cleaner Than France Today?, which uses publicly available information and internationally accepted values for the carbon intensity of different electricity sources to compare the electricity supplies of the two countries. The difference is rarely less than 10 to 1 in favor of France. For the telling absurdity of demolishing a wind installation to expand the lignite pits, which feed the Garzweiler power station, see this news story, link. The town of Lützerath, link, is one among many. The forest of Hambach, link, is a particularly ignoble instance of ecological vandalism in the name of the environmentalism which rejects fission and accepts coal. And then on page 13 I have talking about, in fact, the whole history of central station power negatives the claims made against it. Central stations were first built mostly to provide motive power to industry. A great savings in machinery and fuel could be made by serving a number of factories from one powerhouse compared to the old distributed power plan of a steam engine for each factory. With a modest additional investment, supplies were extended to business offices in the area, and even paying several times what the factories paid per kilowatt hour, the energy efficiency of the incandescent lamp as compared to gas light, and the superior quality of its light made it a good bargain. Within a few years, supplies were extended to the homes of the wealthy, and not long after the not so wealthy, because it was easier to serve them than not. With every new subscriber, prices fell. And then I have a note to that. Thomas Edison's Pearl Street Station, which entered service in September of 1882, initially served only lighting loads, but this was not typical. There was already a desire for transmission of power from central stations to operate machinery, if only to avoid the cost and complication of maintaining boilers. Beginning in 1871, and there's a link there, power from steam central stations was distributed hydraulically in London, and operations ended only in 1977. The pipes are now used for communication cables. Early on in Niagara, it was proposed to distribute power by compressed air, as was being done on a modest scale in Paris. For Martin Cooney, the opposition he faced in a period when the death of premature babies was often called a wholesome weeding out of the unfit, and the Coney Island sideshow, see this book review. That's refers to the next paragraph, talking about streetcar lines, amusement parks, and the electric baby incubator, which you might not have known were connected. And then page 16 here, where I say, If solar enthusiasm does more to exacerbate inequality than to solve energy supply problems, that does not prove that nuclear enthusiasm can do better. Having asked the question for the world as a whole, we will try to answer it for the United States of America, which is one of the largest users of energy overall and on a population basis. If the USA cannot be nuclearized, it stands to reason that the world cannot. And I say, to properly consider the problem of a transition to nuclear energy would require comprehensive information on topics such as the effect of energy costs on overall economic conditions and of overall economic conditions on energy demand, extent of uranium resources and the variation of cost of production from those resources with annual output, cost of power from converters and breeders at different uranium prices, cost of capital equipment for electrifying various industries, and the possible competition for capital and manpower between power system construction and electrification of end uses. In fact, only scant information is available on most of these topics, and its reliability is questionable, despite the best efforts of statisticians, economists, and engineers, among others. Some of it may not even be possible to obtain. Therefore, if we are to answer a question, we must ask a simpler one. And then there's a very long footnote to page 18 where I say the important thing is, fuel cycle studies indicate that fast neutron breeder and slow neutron converter reactors can work together in synergism. Rather than attempt a tedious and confusing explanation in words, this has been given in the form of a diagram. The important thing is that each gigawatt of installed capacity of reactors like the S-PRISM should be able to keep 1.5 to 2 gigawatts of CANDU reactors operating at the same load factor fueled when uranium and plutonium are recycled. With help from thorium, that support ratio becomes 2.5. So, there's this very long footnote here where I say, the breeder reactor has proven a conundrum for economists. Partly this is because of the strong influence of technical details, such as the cost of fuel refabrication or the loss of fissile material in reprocessing. It is also difficult to evaluate the capital cost of breeders when few have been built. In fact, I want to go page up. Yes. Even with two recent nuclear power projects so similar as Hinkley Point C and Baraka, both using pressurized water reactors, the most common type, of about 1,500 megawatts electrical output each, the spread in cost per installed kilowatt of capacity is more than a factor of 5. A survey of the literature, however, reveals a total lack of consensus on methods. The price of plutonium, for instance, has variously been set based on an equivalent quantity of enriched uranium, which depends on the design of the reactor it is to be used in, as well as on the costs of uranium and enrichment, at the full cost of recovering it from discharged fuel, or even at zero, where reprocessing is considered a vital part of waste management and its cost is paid by the operator of the reactor discharging the fuel. Consequently, it is possible to find a study supporting pretty much any position. It does not help that breeders of different designs produce different average numbers of new fissile atoms per fissile atom consumed, up to a maximum of about 2.1, which would be very difficult to obtain in practice. Different quantities of net fissile material per unit of energy output, and different annual quantities of net fissile material per ton of fissile investment in the core. The concept of the support ratio can help greatly in disentangling the confusion. Converters of different designs, operated in a closed fuel cycle, require different amounts of makeup fissile material per unit of output. That's, I put a space there instead of a hyphen, didn't I? Make that N dash instead of NBSP. If we require a certain amount of energy from the overall nuclear installation, and the deficit on the converter side is to be balanced by the surplus on the breeder side, then we see two main possibilities. With breeders which produce only a modest fissile surplus per unit of energy, as is typical of designs using ceramic fuel, such as the French Super Phoenix, and converters with a large makeup requirement, such as the PWR, it would take more than 1 watt of breeder capacity to feed each watt of converter capacity. In this case, converters will probably not be built after the breeders begin to be built on a large scale, and the surplus fissile from the breeders will mostly be dedicated to starting up further breeders. For breeders which produce more fissile, typical of metal fuel designs, such as EBR2 and its derivatives, and converters which require less, such as CANDU, each watt of breeder capacity can support considerably more than 1 watt of converter capacity. This leads to a mixed system of breeders and converters. And then I think I may move this whole supporting calculation down a bit, but currently it's there, and so I have this to say. To simplify calculation, a 100% annual load factor has been used. In other words, each gigawatt of reactor capacity is taken as generating 8,760 gigawatt hours of electricity a year. This is not possible in practice, and as a result, in any real system, the investment of fuel in reactor cores per gigawatt year of generation will be greater. As a further simplification, only the annual fuel use of the converter reactors has been considered. Of course, a reactor cannot be started up without a full load of fuel, and if a fuel bundle stays in the reactor for 3 to 5 years, then a corresponding amount is required in the beginning. This can be offset to an extent by part loading with plain thorium or depleted uranium, and by fuel shuffling, but it is a complicating effect which must be accounted for in framing a realistic model. And here I think I want to move that into a different place. So I'm gonna make that a paragraph rather than a dictionary definition. Now, and then I'm gonna move down here. Move this down here. Yes. And okay. Come back up here. Okay. Then we make this a paragraph. Yes. Okay. And then we move it here. To below here. Yeah. Okay. And delete these unneeded extra tags. Okay. And I want to put in an anchor for this. Inch 2. Calculation. Now, people talking about ham radio in calm. Okay, and so page 22, I've got two notes on page 22. The first one, where are we to put all these power plants, even if we can build and fuel them? A nuclear station disturbs its surroundings less than almost any other industrial facility. There is no smoke or fume, no constant rumble of coal trains. The safety record of CANDU in particular fully justifies locating it in the environs of even the largest cities. The Pickering accident of 1983 showed vividly that, even in an extreme scenario, there is no realistic chance of consequences beyond the plant boundary fence. So, there's a note here to that. On 1st August 1983, while operating under full load, Reactor 2 at Pickering Nuclear Generating Station near Toronto, Ontario, suffered the rupture of a pressure tube. And there I've got a link to the International Atomic Energy Agency's International Nuclear Information Service to the report on the event from the Canadian Nuclear Society. A sudden failure of the primary pressure boundary is considered perhaps the most severe kind of accident that could occur to a power reactor. In a pressure vessel water reactor, such as PWR or BWR, it would be absolutely catastrophic and must be prevented at all costs. Operators brought the stricken reactor to a safe, depressurized condition without needing to invoke the emergency systems, and without any radiation exposures to personnel or radioactive releases to the environment beyond the very small ones of ordinary operation. The reactor was subsequently repaired and returned to service, although this required more than 2 years, because a detailed examination found that further failures were likely. To prevent this, all the pressure tubes of Pickering Reactors 1 and 2 were replaced with an improved design fabricated from a different zirconium alloy, already adopted for Pickering 3 and subsequent CANDU reactors. Let's see. So I probably can... yes. Probably just say such a speed of it. And then the next paragraph is, siting near the load centers has two advantages. First, it minimizes the acrimony over long-distance transmission lines. Second, it allows running hot water pipelines to the heavily built-up areas. Not only winter heat, but also summer cooling, the necessary absorption chillers are already in use in Manhattan, that's a little parenthetical phrase, can thus be provided using what would otherwise be waste energy. Low-grade heat also finds wide use in the industry. This is conservation at its best. And so I have a second note here to the same page. Not only winter heat, but also summer cooling. Extracting low-temperature heat from the bottom of the thermodynamic cycle of a power station, where the conversion efficiency is least, is a well-established way of economizing on fuel. A particular advantage is that it makes available to domestic users heat from fuels such as lignite or heavy oil, which are cheap but require complex and expensive equipment. Nuclear power represents an extreme case of this, and the use of fission for combined heat and power operation goes back at least to the R3 Augusta experimental station near Stockholm, Sweden, which operated 1964 to 74. The very first instance of nuclear space heating appears to have occurred in the autumn of 1951 at Harwell in England using the research reactor BEPO. See Nucleonics, 1951, December. Not 100% sure of that citation because it's in a book which I don't have here with me. I've got to refer to it when I get home. At Betznau in Switzerland is a typical case, and there's another link here to the IAEA INIS to find you the place where the paper occurs. Approximately 8 kilowatt hours of heat are supplied for each kilowatt hour of electric production lost. By pumping hot water at above atmospheric pressure, transmission distances of tens of kilometers become practical. For the advantages of this system over steam, see Fred L. Mosel, Piping Problems Simplified with High Temperature Hot Water Distribution, Architectural Record, 1953. I just so happen to have here at hand a volume called Architectural Engineering, which is compiled from the Architectural Record magazine from about 1940 to 1955. And it talks about the then new campus of Rutgers University and its hot water central heating system. Anyway, then I go on to say, U.S. patent 1,781,541, and I need to link to that, but when I tried to search the USPTO website, wasn't working, probably because it was first thing Sunday morning. Granted 11 November 1930 to Albert Einstein and Leo Szilard, entitled simply Refrigeration, describes the absorption chiller marketed by the Servelle Corporation as the miracle of ice from heat. It is really an invention worthy of those two great lateral thinkers, a purely thermodynamic machine, composed of a sealed loop of tubing, actuated by heat and with circulating fluids as its only moving parts. Absorption chillers today are typically either very large units or very small ones, such as for travel trailers. In the former case, they are typically fired by pipeline gas, sometimes by oil or even coal, whatever fuel is used by the building boiler. In the latter, they are often fitted for operation by bottle gas when the vehicle is parked and electric heat when in motion. For actuation by low-temperature heat, such as from a district heating system or solar collectors, ordinary water under sub-atmospheric pressure is used as the working fluid with an admixture of lithium bromide and extremely hygroscopic salt. Now, interestingly, that's not new, because I found a reference to it in this Architectural Engineering book. In fact, I'm going to go grab that. Yeah. Okay, so... new concepts, new methods, new materials, new applications. But yes, there's a... Where are we? Water-saving devices for air conditioning. And I don't think it's that. Heat pumps. Oh, there's a good article in here about... ultraviolet air sanitation, which I might read for you. But there's a description in here of a building in Dallas, actually, and its innovative heating and cooling system, in which it mentions the use of water as the refrigerant. I'm wondering. That may be on page 156. Air conditioning works with design. Prefabricated floor panels. There's a great deal in here about prefabrication, which I really actually like a lot. But where is it? Here it is. So this is the... I've seen this building, but I've never been in it, I don't think. The Texas Employers Insurance and Employers Casualty Building in Dallas, Texas, which is notable because they use these... outside mullions. I'll read this for you. We ought to have time. Air conditioning works with design for space utilization, flexibility, and economy. George L. Dahl, Architects and Engineers. The tall vertical fins, which stretch up three sides of this Dallas office building, would hardly be thought of as an essential part of its air conditioning system, but actually they conceal the pipes and ducts which heat or cool areas facing the outside. This is just one of several ways in which air conditioning ties in with the design of the structure. In addition, the heavy air conditioning equipment is at the top of the building. Air distribution of the central zones is designed to permit major changes in room partitions without the air conditioning system being disturbed. And in keeping with these concepts, one of the newest developments in refrigeration equipment is being used. This 14-story office building, with basement, is sheathed in aluminum and glass, with the lower storefronts being limestone and granite, and the uppermost and rear sections cream-colored brick. It is scheduled for occupancy February 1, 1950. Air conditioning piping outside the building. The air and water used for air conditioning the exterior zones is distributed from the 12th floor down the outside of the building. Pipelines encased in the triangular aluminum pilasters, or fins, run from the 3rd floor to a point halfway between the 12th and 13th floors. Besides being functional, the placement of these pipes on the exterior of the building structure accomplishes the dream of designers to have straight lines in the building interior. Except for windows, each interior face of the exterior wall is a flat surface. Each fin carries an air conduit, two water pipes, and a drain, which, together with window conditioner units, comprise the high-pressure conduit type of air conditioning employed. The air conduit, 13 inches in diameter in some places, would make an appreciable encroachment on the occupied space if it were installed in the conventional manner. So, to eliminate this, the piping and air conduit were placed in the vertical fins on the outside of the structure. These fins, made of aluminum and insulated on the inside with 1 inch of blanket-type insulation, form the main motif of the building. Precast perlite blocks provide backup insulation for the aluminum fins and spandrel panels. At each floor, there are runouts from the pipes and the fins to window units, which air condition the exterior zones. Central heating and cooling zones. In order to attain a high degree of flexibility in location of partitions, the conditioned air in the central zones is distributed through a perforated tile ceiling. The use of metal perforated tile and acoustical pads allows the air supply to be shifted from one section of the ceiling to another without changing its appearance. Air is discharged from ductwork between the suspended ceiling and the floor slab above. Wherever an air outlet is needed, the acoustical pads are omitted. It is possible, therefore, to change the air distribution at will simply by moving the acoustical pads from one cell to another. The cells are held in place by friction clamps of a T-bar type of construction. The use of flush troffer fluorescent lights makes it possible for lights and tile to be interchangeable. Partitions can be rearranged without involving extensive time and cost in modifying air conditioning and lighting to suit the new partition pattern. Well, that's handy, isn't it now? Heavy air conditioning equipment on top floors. In the early design stages, it was decided that, functionally and economically, it would be feasible to locate major air conditioning equipment on the top floors. The space in the basement was considered too valuable to give up for boiler and machine room space. With the type of heating and cooling plant, this did not impose any difficult engineering problems. I have to stop and explain that the soil conditions in Dallas are very bad for basement excavation. Structurally, the building had to be strengthened somewhat to carry the weight imposed by the air conditioning equipment. This weight, however, is quite minor in comparison to the normal loads the structure has to carry. A small amount of space is gained throughout the building itself because no bulky stacks go up through the building and there are no condenser water pipes to take up space. Since the architectural treatment of the building necessitates that the central air handling system be located at the top of the building, there is a large saving in piping because of the proximity of the refrigerating equipment to the major air cooling system. Likewise, savings are made in steam piping by having the boilers located adjacent to the major steam-consuming apparatus. Latest in refrigeration units used. Contrary to the popular concept, steam, ordinarily used for heating only, is also being used for refrigeration. Steam absorption units, successfully used in several pilot installations and just recently placed on the active market, were selected to provide the refrigeration. While they are in this case a little more expensive than centrifugal machines, it is anticipated that a lower operating cost will affect a worthwhile saving in power costs. The new unit uses plain water as a refrigerant and a simple salt as an absorbent. That's lithium bromide, almost certainly. Water to be chilled is sprayed into an evaporator maintained at an almost perfect vacuum. Due to this high vacuum, a portion of the water vaporizes, cooling the remaining water, which is pumped to the load. The vaporized water goes into an absorber where it is taken up by the salt solution. The heat liberated by the absorption of the water vapor is transferred to cooling water. Since the absorption of the water vapor reduces the salt concentration of the solution, reducing its absorbing power, it must be reconcentrated. Steam heats the solution and boils off the water vapor previously absorbed by the salt solution. The absorption principle is not new, however, it has been in extremely limited use for heavy-duty applications because of the lack of a refrigerant-absorbent combination that was both safe and efficient. Machines of this type, using ammonia, are not suitable for air conditioning because of the toxic qualities of ammonia. Special ventilation for basement garage. Most of the basement is for car storage. Mechanical ventilation is provided to safeguard the health of those working in the area. Large quantities of air travel the full length of the garage and are then exhausted by mechanical means. The exhaust ductwork is arranged so that there are grills at both the floor and the ceiling to ensure removal of gases regardless of where they collect. Yeah, that's a that is a different thing there. Of course, one of the reasons that Einstein invented the absorption chiller was so that it could be a completely sealed piping loop without any pumps or anything, and no seals, right, just totally welded, so there'd be less chance of a refrigeration leak. But even still, it was considered that this was possible, and so they were not terribly suitable for air conditioning. Now, when it comes to removal of gases in parking garages, I will note I've seen a number of placards in Munich underground parking garages that say, only gasoline or diesel vehicles. Now, I don't think this has anything to do with battery electric cars. I believe this is a fire code regulation from the period of the Second World War, when many private cars were powered by charcoal burners. Now, piping problems simplified with high-temperature hot water distribution. And I'm just going to read as much of this as I'm going to get through. 1. Characteristics of high-temperature hot water distribution and its advantages. 2. Development of a high-temperature system for Rutgers University. By Fred L. Mosel, consulting engineer. And there's a schematic diagram of the plant. Most of us are familiar with gravity and forced hot water heating systems for buildings, using temperatures up to approximately 220 degrees Fahrenheit. But now we are hearing about high-pressure, high-temperature hot water systems in the neighborhood of 400 Fahrenheit, which make possible a wide range of hot water temperatures and can produce steam as well. In other words, high-temperature hot water systems are designed to supply heat over long distances using water as the heating medium instead of steam, and as such, are applicable to district heating, hospitals, airports, industrial buildings, college buildings, etc. The water is in a closed circuit and is kept under pressure corresponding to the desired temperature. For example, water at 375 Fahrenheit would have a pressure of 185 pounds per square inch absolute. It is only recently that high-temperature water distribution systems have been given serious consideration in this country, although they have been used in Europe for many years. CUJKH asks in comm, how does the charcoal car work? The answer is that the charcoal burner serves as a gas generator. In other words, the incomplete combustion of wood or similar substances produces a mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide, largely, with a little bit of methane, which can be drawn into the, mixed with air in a special carburetor and burned in a typical gas engine. It's not nice in any way, shape, or form. And it spews hot cinders and does a bunch of other nasty stuff. But if you have no petrol... Now, one. Characteristics and advantages. There are many advantages inherent in all types of forced hot water distribution systems. I guess I should specify, when I speak of a charcoal burner, I mean a closed retort in which something is burned, typically wood, with an insufficient supply of air to fully combust it. This leaves behind a residue of carbon known as charcoal, but also results in the production of off gases. Yeah, sometimes they were built into trailers, and bizarrely at least, there's one in the Deutsches Museum where the pivot for the trailer fastens to the center of the roof of the car. It's ghastly. Yes. There are many advantages inherent in all types of forced hot water distribution systems. Two of the important ones, which probably will be of most interest to the architect, are 1. Internal corrosion is virtually eliminated. 2. Variation in levels of any terrain does not offer obstacles, since the water is pumped up or down as required. Whereas, with steam, lines must be pitched down in the direction of flow to drain properly, and must be dripped at all low points and when pipes rise. Other advantages of high-temperature hot water distribution include 1. No condensate handling equipment, eliminating steam traps, drip mains, condensate pumps, etc. Anybody who's had anything to do with the New York steam system will recognize that immediately. 2. Flexible close temperature control. 3. Reduction in number of licensed steam plant operators required. 4. Low maintenance cost. 5. Large heat storage capacity of water as compared with steam. 6. Fuel savings up to 20% due to even operation of boilers. Because you can store hot water and thus not have to serve peak loads by upfiring your boiler. In a steam system, the drips and the drip system are the weak links which often require the opening of conduits for expensive repairs and replacement. The condensate or water running in the bottom of steam pipes to the drip points in the presence of steam erode the bottom of the pipe and ultimately wear the pipe to the point where replacement is required. After installation of a high-temperature water system, changes affecting carrying capacity of the water mains are easily handled, and if the existing pumps cannot handle the pressure required for the change in resistance, the pump can be replaced, or in some instances, just the impeller is changed. The first cost of a complete system, including the boilers, distribution system, converters, and appurtenances, is usually about 20% below the cost of the corresponding steam system, depending on design. Operating cost savings can approach the same figure. We feel that the high-temperature hot water mains will outlast at least 2 replacements of steam mains which have been destroyed, as described above, and will have a life equal to the buildings connected to them. As long as the conduit remains watertight, outside deterioration of the mains is eliminated, and the remaining destructive force would be friction or the wear incurred by the continuous circulation of water over many years' time. A water distribution system permits selection of temperature levels to accommodate the particular problem. If the requirements call for space heating only, moderate temperatures to approximately 240 Fahrenheit may be used, and these can be standard low-pressure boilers where the pressure limitation is 10 to 15 pounds per square inch gauge for non-licensed engineers. In New York City, where the limit is now 10 pounds, the water would be limited to approximately 230 F. Where requirements call for steam supply in any building on the circuit for purposes such as laundry, kitchen, or laboratory equipment, a temperature sufficiently high to generate steam at the desired pressure can be selected. The generation of steam from high-temperature hot water through an unfired heat exchanger eliminates the need of licensed steam plant operators and thereby reduces operating costs. Assume 40-pound steam, that's PSI gauge, is required for a kitchen. To generate it, it would be necessary to have a minimum flow temperature in the system of 315F. To generate 15-pound steam for laboratory service, 275F minimum flow temperature would be required. Hot water heating systems with modern controls are the most economical in fuel consumption, since, by varying the water temperature circulated, the heating demands can be very closely met and practically all overheating is eliminated.
Also, the water has a high heat storage capacity so that boilers can be fired evenly. It is of utmost importance to select the proper conduit to house these lines. The piping itself has a life which will be limited internally only by water wear in the pipe and will probably outlast several mediocre conduit replacements. The replacement of the conduit, when required, should not be delayed to the extent of permitting outside corrosion to destroy the pipe. In some localities, high-temperature water up to 400 Fahrenheit at 235 pounds pressure or more can be used without licensed engineers. By using special boilers filled with chemicals, flow temperatures to 550 F or more can be attained without developing any pressure, since the boiler is actually vented outdoors. A converter is used, wherein this heated chemical is circulated in the coils by a pump, which then heats the water in the storage part of the converter to the desired temperature of 400 Fahrenheit or as required, which is then under a pressure of 235 psi absolute or another corresponding pressure for the selected water temperature. However, the converter being a so-called unfired vessel should take that classification, for which codes do not require a licensed operator, although some building or other inspectors may be hesitant on the approval. These are designs for which specialized knowledge is required. Two, the distribution system at Rutgers. Several years ago, Rutgers University started the planning and development of a new campus across the Raritan River from the main campus. The architects are York and Sawyer of New York City, and approximately 14 major buildings are included. The first permanent structure was the chemistry building. Included in the plan was provision for a conventional steam distribution system with a connection from our original boiler house. Contracts for the chemistry building construction were awarded, but installation of any steam provisions was omitted until actually required for the finished building. During 1948, we became interested in the use of high-temperature hot water for distribution of heat in other than industrial buildings. There seemed to be no reasons why the high-temperature hot water system should not be substituted for our steam system, since it would give large savings in first cost, provide maximum flexibility, and a life possibly exceeding that of several steam systems or the buildings themselves. The life of a campus being long, these savings can be compounded into tremendous figures, especially if consideration is given to a price index, which is constantly increasing. It became necessary to install a connection from the original boiler house to the chemistry building for heating and for some steam process work. Since we were fully sold on the idea of high-temperature water, one section of the future high-temperature water system was installed between the boiler house and the chemistry building. This section consisted of two 12-inch lines for the high-temperature hot water system and one 3-inch line for a future central compressed air system. One of the 12-inch lines was used temporarily for steam from our existing boilers, and the 3-inch compressed air line was used as a temporary pump discharge line, returning the condensate to the boiler house. A converter, which might be visualized as a boiler without a fire, will be used in the chemistry building. A bundle of tubes containing high-temperature hot water installed near the bottom of the converter take the place of the usual coal or oil fire. A converter does not require a fireman, being completely automatic and having a trouble alarm line to the boiler house to warn of a failure of control devices. All buildings on the circuit will be equipped with a steam or medium temperature hot water converter for each different requirement, which cannot be a subdivision of another requirement. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll probably read them out over the air. I'll probably send you something in return. And coming.